Hello, welcome along. My name's Dan. Thanks for listening to the show. This week, on the world-famous, award-winning Fun Kids Science Weekly, we will travel all around the universe to learn some of the secrets that it's keeping. And this week, that's properly true, actually, because we're joined by Dr. Maggie Adarin-Pocock, a friend of the show. She's back on because she's designed a tour through the solar system. She'll tell us all about it. I might even try and get her to answer one of your spacey questions. That's on the way. We'll also chat about one of the most amazingly designed birds in the sky. And I've got news for you about a brand new comet. It's on the way on the Science Weekly. First, let's catch up with one of our favourite inventing geniuses. This is Sir Sidney McSprocket, and he's telling us how things that we use every single day are made.
How's it made?
Oh, hello. Sir Sidney McSprocket here. I've been in action capturing facts all about manufacturing. It's for this rather splendid stipendiary compendium I'm compiling. You just ask it how something is made, and it'll oblige with a fulsome explanation. Now, I'm very fond of a balloon. My wee niece Denise from Dumfries had a balloon that played a tune, would you believe it? But how are balloons made? Balloons are made of a stretchy rubber material called latex. That's a white, milky liquid made of rubbery particles in water. Latex has great elasticity. Oh, it can be stretched 8 times its original length and still return to its former shape.
Step one.
Liquid latex is sieved to make sure there's no lumps, and then dye is added to give the balloons a lovely bright colour. It's mixed for many hours so that the colour is nice and even.
Step two.
Balloons are made using a solid form. Well, that's a model the size and shape of a balloon that hasn't been blown up. Rows of these forms are dipped into a coagulate. Well, that's a chemical which helps the latex stick to the form in a nice, even layer.
Step three.
The forms are then heated to around 90 degrees Celsius before being dipped in the coloured latex for a few seconds.
Step four.
Brushes or rollers are used to sweep the bottom of the balloon into a little lip. That's the part you'll put into your mouth.
Step five.
A lovely hot bath comes next. This helps to vulcanize the balloons. Now, vulcanization may sound somewhat out of this world, but it's got nothing to do with aliens. It's a process that makes the substance of the balloon much tougher and less likely to snap or pop when it's blown up.
Step six.
After a dusting of special powder, air and suction is used to pull the balloons from the forms, and then they're ready for packing. Now, count yourself lucky that technology has moved on. Around 100 years ago, if you wanted a balloon, chances are that it would have been from the bladder of an animal. You wouldn't fancy blowing that up now, would you? Now, I must get on, but come back soon and find out more about manufacturing with my splendid stipendiary compendium.
How's it made? With support from the Royal Commission for the 1851 exhibition. Find out more at funkidslive.com.
Right, it's time for my favourite part of the show, question time, where you send your questions to me over on the Apple Podcast Store. And then I become like a science sleuth, a sciencey Sherlock. I do all the legwork to figure it out for you. I read books, I look through encyclopedias, I chat to experts, search through the internet, trying to figure it out for you. This one is from Rory in Bangkok, who asks, how do people get allergies? What happens inside your body as well when you eat something that you're allergic to? Now, this is quite a complex answer, Rory. I'm going to give you the simple one for now. Well, an allergic reaction is what happens when your immune system reacts to a substance from the outside world that you come into contact with, maybe on your skin or through your mouth, maybe pollen or venom or types of food. What happens is that your immune system reacts to this by making antibodies. Now, antibodies are a protein that normally help fight bacteria and viruses that are in your body. But your immune system mistakenly identifies what you're allergic to as something that's harmful, even though normally it isn't. For instance, I'm allergic to apples quite a lot of the time. Apples aren't really harmful, but when I put one inside my mouth, the antibodies in my body think it's something really nasty. These antibodies are created to try and fight what they think is nasty, and then you get the swelling and the sniffing and every other type of reaction that you get is effectively the antibodies attacking your own body. Now, why we get allergies can sometimes be quite strange. Have a listen to this, right? Some scientists, they think that this is due to a really, really, really old reaction to parasitic worms. Ages ago, before modern health and safety, parasitic worms found it relatively easy to get into our bodies and to cause us all kind of damage. Now, some scientists think that the proteins of this parasitic worm back in the day are the same shape as some of the things that we now come into contact with. So when you eat something that you're allergic to, it triggers a really old defense mechanism in your body. Now, that's all I'm really going to do for you now, Rory. I think there's so many more questions that I can ask a proper allergy genius about this, so I'm going to try and get a specialist for you on the show soon. Thanks so much for that. Lastly, let's make this a short one because that was kind of long. This is from Will and Charlie, who are over in Abu Dhabi, who asks, how do turtles get their shells? Now, it's not like snails who can trade in one shell for another that they might find on their travels. A turtle shell is never too big, it's never too small, it never falls off because it grows with their body. It's made from their rib cage and their spine, it's attached to them. The scutes, which are the plates that make up the shell, they shed a bit like a snake along the way. They peel away when they don't fit on the shell anymore, and then a new one grows in its place, and that's bigger. There you go. That's how a turtle gets its shells. Thank you so much, Will and Charlie. If you've got a question that you want answered on this show, you need to send it over to me by leaving it as a review over on the Apple Podcast Store. It's the Fun Kid Science Weekly. This week, we're joined by friend of the show, back on the phone, Dr. Maggie Adarin-Pocock, space genius TV presenter, and she wants to help you explore the galaxy in her brand new book, Grand Tour of the Solar System. Hey, Dr. Maggie.
Hello.
Thank you so much for joining us. So I thought we'd start right at the very centre of the solar system, okay? If we were to leave the sun, we're travelling outwards from the sun and hopefully not get too charred, what would be what's the first thing that we'd encounter?
The sun is sort of, like a ball of gas, and as you say, incredibly hot. I think 15 million degrees, so pretty hot. So we do have to be careful of charring. But as we leave the sun, the first planet we'd encounter, if it was in the right position of our direction, would be Mercury.
Is there nothing between Mercury and the sun? There's no like little asteroids floating around?
Not as far as we know. Nothing that we've spotted so far.
So we've finished Mercury. I don't want to go through everything in the solar system because that's kind of the point of the book. But when we're on Mercury, talk to us a bit more about that first planet. What makes it a planet? Why is it the first thing that we come across? And what would it be like to live there?
So Mercury is, if you see pictures of Mercury, they look very much like the moon. So Mercury has sort of a no atmosphere. It is sort of a slightly bigger than the moon. So it's not that, it's one of the smallest planets in the solar system. Also, Mercury has one side that points towards the sun and one side that points away to the sun. So on one side, it is super hot. And on the other side, it is incredibly cold because it's looking at the darkness of space. There's a probe on its way to Mercury as we speak, and it's called Bepi Colombo. And hopefully it's going to tell us a lot more about Mercury. But yes, Mercury is quite an interesting planet, but very close to the sun. Another thing is you can actually see Mercury with a naked eye, but you have to be very careful. Because Mercury's orbit is very close to the sun, you can usually see Mercury usually just as the sun is setting, and you need to know where to look in the right place. But we can see Mercury with a naked eye.
We've got these planets in our solar system, Maggie. Why are there not more? This is quite a hard question to even ask. I can't quite figure it out. So at the very start, the origin of the solar system, you've got all these things flying around and then gravity sucks them together. Is there a chance that more planets could be made in our solar system if more stuff was flying around?
Yeah, so it's quite interesting because we think that perhaps in the past there were more planets. and the asteroid belt, which lies between Mars and Jupiter, that could have been a planet that didn't quite come to fruition, or came to fruition but got sort of bombarded and smashed up or pulled apart by Jupiter's gravity. Also, in the planets of the solar system, there was a period called sort of the period of sort of a grand bombardment, and everything in the solar system was moving around. Over periods of thousands of years, the solar system, as we know it, wasn't as stable as it is now. And so things were moving apart, things were moving around, things were bombarding together. And but we're in a period of stability now. But in the future, we could go into a period of planetary migration again.
We've spoken about the start of our solar system from the middle point, the sun. What about right at the end? When you pass the last planet, why does it suddenly stop?
Oh, well, it doesn't. It's quite interesting. So we've got Mercury, Venus, Earth, Mars. You've got the gas giants, Jupiter and Saturn. You've got the ice giants, Uranus and Neptune. But then you've got what we call trans-Neptunian objects. And Pluto, which was a planet for a while, but because it's smaller than the moon, we've actually downgraded it to a dwarf planet. And you have a number of other dwarf planets out there. But then you have a sort of like a donut ring of debris called the Kuiper Belt. And Kuiper Belt objects are quite interesting. They can be as large as things like Pluto, but they can be sort of as small as just lumps of rock. You'd virtually find in the garden for icy rocks because it's very cold out there. And so you have this sort of this donut ring around the solar system. And again, I think this is debris left over from when the solar system formed. But then if you go even further, far, far beyond that, you get something we believe is called the Oort cloud, which is like a sphere of matter surrounding our solar system. And we've never spotted the Oort cloud, but we think it's there because lots of comets and things like that come from space seem to come from one area, and they seem to be coming from the Oort cloud. So it doesn't actually stop with the planet. There's lots of other interesting things. And the thing is, because we don't get out that far very often, and there is a probe out there at the moment called New Horizon, and it flew past Pluto, and it's now sort of travelling in the Kuiper Belt. And it's sort of it went to see another planet, another, not a dwarf planet, but another asteroid out there called Ultima Thule. So it's travelling out there and seeing what's out there, because it's so far away, we're not really sure exactly what is out there.
I mean, the solar system, Dr. Maggie, is the solar system because everything inside is orbiting the sun. When you're leaving things that are orbiting our sun, how far do you need to go before you're meeting another extraterrestrial body that's orbiting something else?
Yes. So our solar system is, it's all centered around the sun. But what we're doing now is we're finding solar systems around other stars. So our sun is surprisingly just like the stars we see in the night sky. Some of them are bigger, some of them are smaller, but they're all suns like our sun. If you travel in the right direction, the next star you'll get to is a star called Proxima Centauri. And very excitingly, about sort of 3 or 4 years ago, we found a planet orbiting Proxima Centauri. And what we're discovering now is that we thought that perhaps we were the only solar system out there. But what we're discovering is most of the stars out there have planets going around them. So we're not the only solar system. But if you were going to use conventional technology to travel from our solar system to Proxima Centauri and its solar system, that journey would take 76,000 years. And that's traveling at 10.5 miles a second. So the distance between the stars is very, very great. And to put that into perspective, it's 4.28 light years, and that equates to 40 trillion kilometres. So it's a pretty long way away.
Let me just bring you back to our solar system. You mentioned the gas giants, the ones in the middle. You've got Jupiter and you've got Saturn. Very simply, taking away the logic of me actually dying, if I were to jump out of a spaceship, I've got a spacesuit on and everything. If I were to leap out of a spaceship right into Jupiter, would I float the whole way down? Is there anything for me to put my feet on?
Well, this is one of the mysteries of Jupiter. With these gas giants, we can sort of look at the outer edges and we see violent storms sort of travelling around the sort of circumference of Jupiter, and also sort of at the poles as well. But Jupiter, if you took planet Earth, you could fit 1,000 planet Earths into one Jupiter. So Jupiter is huge. And so it has huge gravity. So if you were to take sort of the ultimate plunge and dive into Jupiter, for one thing, as you got closer and closer to the center, the temperature would rise. So you'll get a bit sort of frazzled. But as well as that, the pressures would be huge. And so not only, I think, would you be a bit frazzled, you'd also be very crushed as well. So I wouldn't recommend it.
No. You mentioned gravity there. I think that's going to play a hand with this question. Dr. Maggie, we get questions from all over the world. They're sent through to us through our Apple podcast page, and we try and get experts to answer them. Now this, I thought I'd try your hand with this. This is from Archie, who would like to know how a black hole is formed. I understand, Dr. Maggie, that's a huge concept, but if you if you could try and sum it up neatly for us, that would be appreciated.
Yes. As you say, it is all about gravity. But gravity is the force. The more stuff there is in something, so the more mass, the more of a gravitational force that will exert. Now, when we mentioned sort of stars, and we look at in the night sky, we see sort of thousands of stars. In our galaxy, there are about 300 billion stars, so that's a mind-blowing number. But stars come in different shapes and sizes, but stars also go through a life cycle. They're born like the star at the center of our solar system was born, by matter coming together. And they sort of all come together, and a star, if you get enough matter together, then a star is formed. But a star goes through a life cycle. It's born, and then it sort of shines brightly because of fusion happening in its center. But then when it comes to the end of its life, a number of things can happen. Our local star will actually just get sort of bigger and bloated, and it will turn into what we call a red giant. And it will gobble up Mercury, Venus, and Earth in about 4.5 billion years, so we don't need to worry. But other stars, which are much more massive than our sun, die in a very different way. Some go supernova, where they're making a sort of energy at the center by fusion, and the gravitational force is pulling in, and these two forces balance each other out. But towards the end of their lives, this balance gets out of kilter, and the gravitational force starts winning because they're running out of fuel in the center to counteract it with the fusion. And so what happens is the star collapses in on itself, and what happens is it gets sort of more and more and more dense. And for really big stars, it gets so dense that it actually punches a hole in space-time. So it gets so dense that sort of the force of gravity is sort of overwhelming. And eventually you can form a black hole that way. And if you form a black hole that way, not even light can escape from that. And black holes are very interesting because it's like a sphere in space, which you can't actually see. But anything around that sphere can get sucked in. We have something called an event horizon, which is a bigger sphere which surrounds the black hole. And anything that goes inside that event horizon, the force of the black hole is so great that it can't escape and things get sucked in. And as they get sucked in, there's a brilliant term called spaghettification. As you get sucked in, you get sort of elongated into spaghetti as you go into the black hole. Now, it's funny having this sphere where things get sucked in, but nothing seems to come out. So the mystery is, when you go into a black hole, where does that matter? Where does all that energy, what happens to the stuff that goes into a black hole? Now, people talk about sort of parallel universes or the multiverse, or yeah, perhaps it comes out in a white hole somewhere else. But the fact is, black holes are still very much a mystery.
I've had black holes explained to me many, many, many times, and it just takes me, like, I think I'm 75% of the way there, and I'll give you a call one time to just help me top up that last 25%, I think. Listen, Dr. Maggie Adarin-Pocock, thank you so much for joining us on the show. The book Grand Tour of the Solar System is out now. It's a fantastic tour right from the sun all the way out past Pluto and beyond. Maggie, thank you so much for joining us on the show.
Lovely to speak to you. Thanks so much.
Now, this week's Dangerous Dan was suggested to me, thrown my way by Astro Archie over on that Apple podcast store again. And it's all about the fastest animal in the world. The peregrine falcon is the fastest member of the animal kingdom. The highest measured speed is 242 miles an hour. They're found across the world as well, from the Arctic tundra to the tropics. Now, let's get this out of the way. This is called Dangerous Dan, but because they're, well, a bird, they're not that dangerous to humans, but for other animals, they're incredibly deadly, and that counts. And the way that they're deadly is really worth talking about. It feeds on other birds, it takes them out in midair. Now, because they move at such ridiculous speeds, they need this big area to search for prey, because, you know, they travel such a long distance over such a short time, it needs to be big. When they're on the hunt, though, they're incredibly agile. They turn, twist over 200 miles an hour. And it's actually because they move at such high speeds that they can turn so quickly and they can roll so agilely, and the gravity helps them out with this. They're thought to have sight that's 8 times better than our own. They can see prey from a distance of 3 kilometres away. Which means, let me do the maths, 3 kilometres, 240 miles an hour. It would take them around 30 seconds to go and get prey that's 3 kilometres away. They've actually got a third eyelid as well to protect their eyes in a dive. And very quickly, talking about how they're designed for speed, this is pretty good. Scientists designed the first jet engines based on the peregrine's nostril as a model. They were confused at why airplane engines started choking out at high speeds. And by copying the way that peregrines breathe, they built a cone in the middle of the jets so the air can pass through it safely. It's an incredible beast. It's even influenced airplanes, and it can take out other animals in the air. So it's definitely worth a place on our Dangerous Dan list. It's time to catch up with another one of our science geniuses on the show now. This is Marina Ventura. She's here to tell us all about the climate.
Marina Ventura's Climate Explorers.
Hi there, Marina Ventura here. Now, as we've been finding out, when you hear the words weather and climate, you might think they mean the same thing, but they're quite different. Isn't that right, Maffy?
Hi, Marina. Yes, that's correct. It might be rainy today or it might be sunny. That's the weather. But climate is the pattern of weather in a place over a much longer time.
And different parts of the world have very different patterns of weather. Why is that?
The Earth's climate is driven by energy from the sun, which arrives in the form of heat. Half of this energy travels through our atmosphere and reaches the Earth's surface. The other half is either absorbed by the atmosphere or reflected back into space. Because the Earth is a sphere, the sun's rays reach the Earth's surface in polar regions at a much more slanted angle than at the equator. So straight away, we know that the poles are colder than the equator. Now, when things aren't in balance, nature likes to even things out. So the extra energy at the equator needs to be spread across the planet. And it's this that creates different climate zones across the world. Warm air rises at the equator and moves toward the poles. Where warm, wet air rises, we get thunderstorms and tropical rainforests. And where air sinks, it stops clouds from forming. So it rains less, even making deserts.
So, Map App, how many climate zones are there and how do they differ?
Well, around the equator we have tropical climates, which are hot and humid. This is where you'll find the world's rainforests. Then there are arid or dry climates, like you'd find in deserts. Next is Mediterranean, with hot, dry summers and cooler, wetter winters. And then there are temperate climates.
That's what we have in the UK, isn't it? Where summers are mild and winters aren't too cold.
That's right. In areas that are a very long way from the sea, the climate is continental, with long, cold winters and short, hot summers. Finally, there's polar climates, which experience long periods of extreme cold.
Hang on, though. I've been to countries like France and Italy in the Mediterranean, and depending upon where I am, I've experienced very different weather conditions. They have lots of snow in winter, and some of their mountains are even snow-covered all year round. But they also have beautiful beaches, great fun during the hot and dry summers. So, if you've got both snow-covered mountains and hot beaches, does that mean they don't have a Mediterranean climate?
Of course not. It just means that local climates in a country can be different to the region's climate. This can be for lots of reasons. High places, like mountains, tend to be colder because the air is cooler the higher you go. Vegetation can also affect the local climate we experience. In equatorial rainforests, dense vegetation blocking the wind, combined with high temperatures and rainfall, means it's a very humid place to be. Where there's no vegetation, the air can be much drier and the wind can blow. In busy cities, the air temperature is often warmer than the surrounding countryside, particularly at nighttime. This is due to buildings and roads absorbing heat during the day and giving it off at night. Another thing that can affect a local climate is the wind. It might be that part of a country frequently catches wind from another region. This is called a prevailing wind. If it's coming from a hotter place, this might raise temperatures. Or if it's from a colder area, it will cause the local temperature to drop.
Brrr, I think I want to be back on the beach. This wind's coming from a very cold place. Lovely. Time for a dip.
Even the oceans have a part to play in influencing our weather and climate.
As we shall find out later. Thanks, Mappy. And just because a place has one climate doesn't mean it won't change. Climate scientists take measurements over long periods of time to track patterns in temperature and rainfall. These help us know what to expect today and in the future, but are also a great way to see what changes have happened in the past. Amazing to think that 20,000 years ago, the UK would have been in the Ice Age, and our climate here would have been similar to the polar climates that we see today. Cold enough to have a pet polar bear. Join us next time when we'll be finding out about how and why climates change.
Marina Ventura's Climate Explorers, supported by the Natural Environment Research Council, the science of the natural world. Find out more at funkidslive.com/marina.
Shall we talk about all the science that has been all over your news this week then? Because a newly identified amphibian could be the largest on the planet, according to DNA taken from a museum specimen. The South China giant salamander, it's critically endangered, and renewed conservation efforts are needed to save it from extinction. But scientists have managed to study its DNA from a version of it in a museum, and they found that it can be nearly 2 metres in length. Also, astronomers are gathering measurements on what they think is an interstellar comet, getting clues about its chemical composition. The object, which is named C/2019Q4 Borisov, it's only the second interstellar object ever identified. Thousands of telescopes across the world are looking at it to see how it's different from the comets that we see more regularly. You see, it is interstellar because it's travelling between stars, kind of on its own accord. It's not bound by gravity to an orbit like many other comets are. And finally, the ozone hole over Antarctica could be the smallest in 3 decades right now. Ozone is a molecule that's made of 3 oxygen atoms, and the layer helps keep out harmful ultraviolet radiation from the sun. Now, the pollution that we make makes holes in the layer, which hangs above the Earth, but it seems like we're doing less damage than before. And that is it for this week's Fun Kids Science Weekly. Thank you so much for giving us a listen. If you've got a sciencey question that you need me to become a sciencey Sherlock for and find out the answer for you, leave it as a review, please, over on the Apple Podcast Store. Find the Fun Kids Science Weekly on there. Leave us your name so I know who to say hello to. 5 stars as well really helps me see it. And there's a comment box at the bottom. That's where you leave your question. While you're on the Apple Podcast Store, it's one of the best places that you can hear all the fantastic science series that we do at Fun Kids. You can get it on there, on Google. It's on Spotify as well. You can also have a listen on our free Fun Kids app. And Fun Kids is a children's radio station from the UK. You can find us all over the country on your DAB digital radio, on that Fun Kids app, and at funkidslive.com.